This is
Make It Kind.
M.I.P.
with Masamela Matfumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make It Kind.
Get woke.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Joining us now, happy to have him back, Secretary of Transportation, Secretary Pete Buttigieg. Mr. Secretary, how are you today?
Pretty good. Hope you're well.
I'm well. So, and I hope you are too. The House has voted. It's got to go to the Senate. How are we able to avoid a rail strike this weekend?
Well, if the Senate acts and sends this bill to the president's desk, then we will be able to prevent and to shut down of the rail system that would have devastating consequences for the U.S. economy. What took place today was that Speaker Pelosi brought forward legislation, and you saw a bipartisan vote on a piece of legislation that effectively locks in a tentative agreement that the representatives of the companies and representatives of the labor unions reached a couple of months ago. That agreement isn't perfect, but both the companies and the labor unions moved a lot in order to reach that agreement. And locking that in and moving forward on that is the most straightforward way to prevent a shutdown that would really lead to the shutdown of most of the economy. I mean, it's not just the rail, but everything that depends on rail, whether we're talking about farms, whether we're talking about water treatment plants that need chlorine that can only be efficiently delivered by rail, whether we're talking about the auto industry that often only has a couple of days of parts on hand at any given facility and really counts on that rail system to move. There's no substitute for a fully functioning rail system. And so this is about what it'll take to keep those trains moving so that the economy can keep moving too.
Now, just to bring us up on the chronology, there was an agreement and then there was some walk back on the agreement, right? So if this legislation, if it passes the Senate, what does it do in terms of the parties that had second thoughts about the September agreement?
That's right. So what happened was there were 3 years that the parties were working on this, came to an impasse, which triggered a process where a presidential emergency board brought in a framework for what they recommended to resolve this issue. It included things like a 24% pay increase over 5 years. It included the additional of another personal leave day for employees and some other provisions having to do with healthcare. It, again, wasn't perfect, but it was something that the different parties could agree on. It went out for votes with the different labor unions involved, 12 different labor unions. The majority of them voted, the unions voted for it, but several major ones did not complete that ratification process favorably. And so what that means is that the only sure way to head off a shutdown at this point is for Congress to act. And what the vote did today is it paves the way, provided that the Senate does the same later on this week, to get a bill to the president's desk that he can sign. It's all part of the Rail Labor Act, which I believe dates back to the 20s, that has all of these special provisions to protect the economy because of how important the rail industry is to the country, to lock in those pay increases, those adjustments on things like leave, and keep things moving in our economy.
So do we get the impression that once this goes through and if the Senate passes it, that the demand some of the unions had in terms of, I guess, the extra days of sick leave and pay, how much of that will be met, or will those still be issues that will need to be resolved?
So a lot of workers have a concern that even when they have access in theory to sick days, and often we're talking about unpaid sick days even, that they're not able to actually use them without getting some kind of disciplinary result. And that continues to be an issue and will continue to be an issue even if this legislation is successful. Now, as an administration, as everybody hopefully knows, we believe strongly in paid leave for all Americans, not just any individual industry, but every American worker. And the president has pressed proposals to get that done. We're going to continue pushing for that to happen across the country. But right now, in terms of this situation and the threat to our economy, The focus is on making sure that we don't find ourselves in a matter of just a few days with shipments starting to shut down just ahead of the Christmas season and with everything going on in our economy.
And of course, this would affect both, obviously you alluded to freight. This affects both freight and passenger rail, does it not?
That's right. There are many, in fact, the majority of the miles of passenger rail in this country operate on the same railroad lines that the major freight lines do. Now, the Northeast Corridor is an exception. So this is not implicating that Boston, New York, Washington corridor. But for most of the rest of the country and some commuter rail lines, this could involve a shutdown for them, too. Amtrak would probably begin canceling bookings by Monday or Tuesday so that passengers don't get stranded. At least that's kind of the timeline we talked about earlier. If the deadline is December 9th, the rail companies and operators like Amtrak need to take steps several days ahead of that. And even those kinds of disruptions can take a while for our economy to recover from, which is why there really is a lot of urgency to getting congressional action on this in the next few days.
You feel confident about the Senate seeing this through as we close?
Well, I think so, but not taking anything for granted. There was a strong bipartisan vote in the House. That's encouraging. But this still has to move through the Senate, and it's really important that there not be any kind of the twists and turns that prolong things that we're kind of used to in Washington right now, but there's just not enough time for that. We can't afford to have auto factories in America shutting down, to have farms unable to get their fertilizer, to have water treatment plants unable to get their chlorine. So this has to be a moment when Congress works more quickly than Congress usually does. That happened in the House. We're urging for that to happen in the Senate, too. And I do know that the president will act very quickly once a finished bill reaches his desk.
Secretary Pete Buttigieg of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Secretary Pete, we thank you, as always.
Same here. Thanks for having me on.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should, too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Just a week removed from the Thanksgiving holiday, have it here with us, our friend, once again, for our weekly edition of Thursday Coast, Marcos Melissus, the founder of Daily Coast, the largest online progressive community, the founder of Civics with a Q, and the host of The Brief podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, buddy, how was the holiday?
Holiday was great, and I'm still basking in the glow of being right about the election. So, Mark, we spent the whole year talking, I kept saying, not going to be your typical midterm election. The dynamics are different. It's not going to be a referendum on Joe Biden because it's Donald Trump. The Supreme Court decision on abortion is going to motivate our side in a way that they don't quite realize. And to the very few days before the election, the media kept insisting that there was going to be a red wave. They kept insisting that the issue of abortion had waned, which was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen. A bunch of white men pundits, they didn't care about abortion. So, of course, nobody else cares about abortion. I mean, it's being on here. And Mark, remember, I kept saying, I'm not saying that the Democrats are going to win. I'm saying we don't see evidence of a red wave. And everything that I see points to a very, very close 50-50 election. And that's exactly what we got. You know, it's only about 30,000 votes total, the difference between a Democratic and a Republican held house. And those 30,000 votes were mostly in California, my state, in your state, New York, Mark. It was that close. And so it sort of validates, not that people like me were peddling. People accuse me and others like Simon Rosenberg and Joe Trippi and Tom Bonier. They accuse us of dealing in hopium. Hopium is creating hope, contrary to the evidence. And really what we were doing is we were looking at the data. And this is sort of like what I built Daily Coaster on, right? Mark, we've been talking about this for over a decade. Data. If you look at the data, odds are pretty good you're probably going to get the election right. And understanding the data can sometimes be wrong. We saw that in 2016 when Donald Trump, was selected to the White House, won with a minority of the votes. But generally speaking, we had a lot of data this time. We had special elections. We had voter registration. We had early vote numbers. We had poll numbers. There was a lot for us to work with. And all of it said close election. That's what we got. So I'm still feeling kind of braggy about that, if you would excuse me.
No, that's fine. You were right. It's a good feeling. And I spoke to David Neer of Daily Coast Elections right before the holiday. He was with us. And David, and I said this to David, it doesn't even feel like they won the House for some reason. You know, and this is the most non-feeling loss of the House, the most intangible. The loss of the House I felt. I mean, because if somebody sneezes, you know, or somebody leaves or whatever, I mean, we can almost get it back. What do you think about, obviously, Hakeem Jeffries elected unanimously. The House leadership is now either people of color or women, all the top positions. How do you think this is going to work out in terms of the speaker's election? Because anybody doesn't have to be a Republican elected speaker. I mean, if we wanted to play with them, some of us might go over, somebody was suggesting that earlier, and vote for somebody other than Kevin McCarthy. I don't know, but that's not assured for Kevin McCarthy.
When Paul Ryan was speaker, he was actually, people may not have noticed or they may have forgotten, he was actually not the heir apparent at the time. The heir apparent to Boehner was McCarthy. He was his lieutenant. And yet he didn't get the votes. And Paul Ryan was a compromised candidate. And they had a much larger majority at that time. I think it was like a 30-seat majority. So here's McCarthy once again coming in. And there's a very real chance he's not going to end up speaker. And this is actually a fascinating situation. And Mark, I will argue that this is better for the Democrats, that the Republicans have this very, very, I think it's a 6-seat majority right now in the House. I would argue that actually that's better for them than to have the majority. Would it be nice? Keep investigations going, that sort of thing. But the reason incumbent presidents almost always win, only three have lost in the last 100 years. The reason incumbent presidents do so well is because they lose control of Congress in that midterm election, and then they can run against the do-nothing Congress. This is the playbook. Every president does this. Bill Clinton, remember, he was being impeached and he ran against Congress and won re-election. Barack Obama, Democrats got crushed in 2010, had no problem winning re-election because he ran against Congress. So you have this dynamic where, okay, now the Democrats can point to the Republicans and say nothing's passing. Thing is that all of Biden's legislation, all his real agenda, anything that could have passed has already passed. There's things like obviously like DC statehood and voter rights, but that was going to die in the Senate anyway without getting rid of the filibuster. So there was really nothing the House could do that would get through the Senate at this point. But the Senate can still approve judges. So the one thing Congress is still good for, we have control of that. Like if you have difference between holding the House or holding the Senate, the Senate is by far the most valuable chamber if you have the White House. So we can still get our judges, and now we can run against. And you know, Republicans, their first press conference after the election, it wasn't about inflation. It was not about gas prices. No, it was a Hunter Biden's laptop. So this is what they're going to talk about. So to get to your question, this is a very long about way to say, is that McCarthy does not have the votes. I think 20 members of the Freedom Caucus have already said they will not vote for McCarthy. Now there's going to be horse trading. There's going to be arm twisting. There's going to be those sort of things. But he can only afford to lose six. And by all indications, as far as I can tell, 10 of them are solid, solid no's. Now, who would that compromise candidate be this time? I don't think that's so obvious. So I still think if you had to, you know, let me do odds, I'd say about a 65, 70% chance McCarthy twists enough arms, buys enough people off. But here's the possibilities. These are very real possibilities. One is that Republican moderates look at the concessions that McCarthy is giving to the Freedom Caucus and starts feeling really uncomfortable. Remember, about 25 of those Republicans sit in Biden districts right now. About 10 to 15 of them are in pretty solidly Biden districts in California and in New York, and their chances of surviving a presidential year election are pretty, pretty slim. So anything that says these guys voted with the Freedom Caucus in those campaigns, it's going to be political death for those guys. So they're going to be nervous. They have two choices. One is that those moderates can form a bloc with Democrats to elect a moderate Republican as Speaker of the House. And one of the names floated is Congressman Bacon of Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District. So he's already said, I'll do it if I'm tasked, if people want me to do it. So there's a chance. It's happening in the Alaska legislature. Both the House and the Senate are controlled by a caucus of moderate Republicans and Democrats. Even though Republicans have the majority, both in the Alaska Senate and the House, it's not the Republican Party that is in control. It's this coalition. It's worked very, very, very well in Alaska. So that's a possibility. Second possibility is we're only talking six Republicans need to switch sides, and then suddenly they could actually switch parties, right? Depending on how bad it looks for them, how much the Freedom Caucus is getting, I would make the chances, you know, 2-3%. I'm not going to say it's a big chance, but there's a chance that maybe Democrats can get some of these guys to switch parties. This is the only chance they're going to be in the House in 2 years. So switch parties and Democrats keep control. Not out of the realm of possibilities right now. So where we are right now is that even McCarthy has admitted he does not have the votes, but he's going to take a 12th floor vote. He says he's pushing forward. He's going to force the votes in the House. So once that happens, if the Freedom Caucus holds strong, who the heck knows? Or if McCarthy gives away, you know, just gives everything away to the Freedom Caucus, we may get some of these moderate Republicans starting to feel really, really a little freaked out about their chances in 2 years if they play ball. So it's going to be kind of interesting. And again, chances are it's going to be McCarthy. Chances are he's going to figure out what he needs to do to buy these people off. And he's in. Republican moderates are not the most dependable of people. They always seem to cave. But you never know. Things are interesting. And that's chaos. And then you contrast that with the Democratic side, where Pelosi has been an incredible speaker, and she just masterfully engineered the transition of power to a younger generation of leaders. And the contrast could not be any more stark.
Yeah. No, and it says a lot the way in which they did that and the way that process happened by, you know, making that transition and allowing the new leadership to come forward. Very important. Now, moving on to Georgia, what are your thoughts about the runoff, which is it's over in a few days?
Yeah, I'm feeling really good. The early vote numbers are fantastic. And
has Civics done anything with that?
I mean, we've been tracking that matchup all cycle, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, and but it's been pretty consistent that Warnock, the Democrat, has had about 3 to 4 point lead against Herschel Walker. Now, the thing is, that was the case before the election, right? A lot of it's going to depend on is turnout. Of course, course, turnout is when things are this close, it all comes down to turnout. And I suspect that Republicans are going to have a hard time getting their people out to vote. Now, they did a decent job. Republicans did a decent job of getting people out for Kemp, the governor, and Raffensperger, the secretary of state. And one of the reasons they were successful is that they were able to distance themselves from Trump. Trump helped by going after them, attacking them, threatening them. And so this inoculated them against charges that they were Trump Republicans. And that helped in those suburbs. But still, a lot of people showed up and they voted for Kemp because they liked Kemp. He was unfortunately popular. And voted straight ticket. All right, we'll vote for the Republican. But they came out for Kemp. They did not come out for Walker. Are they going to come out for Walker? And I suspect that they're not going to come out for Walker. We saw this 2 years ago where Democrats dramatically outperformed Republicans in the runoff election. And I don't see anything, again, in the data, I don't see anything that suggests that this year is any different. In fact, it might even be bigger.
Yeah, because there's record turnout, early voting. I was there, I think Monday and Tuesday, was in a few spots.
And just Walker's a god-awful candidate. I mean, candidate quality matters. And 2 years ago, Republicans had decent candidates, right? They were an incumbent senator, Loeffler, Kelly Loeffler, right?
Yeah.
The other guy was the congressman who, you know, so these guys were not fringe MAGA nut candidates. I mean, they were awful in their own way, but they were. Herschel Walker is like another level. Like, he is next level awful.
We were out in the streets in Clayton County, Georgia. That was a Black Voters Matter, and we're out on the intersection, so holding up the signs, giving people information about early voting, giving out free Black Voters Matter t-shirts, just telling people to vote. And Black Voters Matter, just for the record, is not partisan. But a motorist pulls up at the intersection where I am and decides to engage me on a partisan level. He said, I'm not voting. He shouts out, I'm not voting for Raphael Warnock because he's a hypocrite. I said, why is he a hypocrite, sir? And he said, because he's for abortions. And I said, Herschel Walker has paid for abortions. Well, that's different. That was 40 years ago.
It wasn't even 40 years ago.
You know, and then Black Voters Matter came to get me and said, Mark, you really shouldn't be in a partisan debate. You know, I was about to snatch a dude out the car, but they called me.
I'm glad you did.
and he's giving me the thing and just, I think he even had a Confederate flag. But yeah, we can't have Herschel Walker in the Senate. That can't happen under any circumstances. This is an important election. And we've got the majority anyway. But now here's the question. If Warnock is reelected, what is it then?
51-49.
So does that math offset anything, Manchin and Sinema, if they decide to do what they've done in the past on any bill?
What it does is, in the past, we needed both of them for anything. Now, as long as we peel one of them off, we can make it pass. And it's not like they have some kind of alliance where they work in concert together. They've always had their own individual agendas. And so every time we've needed their votes, we've had to cut separate deals with them. And that's now we only have to cut, you know, now I guess we pick the one that's least objectionable and cut that deal. And Mark, it's also 51's important because the map in 2 years is brutal for us. Like there's nothing. Our best pickup opportunities are like Ted Cruz in Texas and in Florida. These are not, you know, quality pickup opportunities. And you never know, you know, times change and the political winds are fickle. And I mean, who knew Arizona and Georgia were going to be this competitive, you know, 6 years ago. So things may happen, but generally speaking, it's not a good map. We're defending seats like Sherrod Brown in Ohio and John Tester in Montana. We're defending really, really difficult seats and not in battleground states. It's one thing to defend our seats in states where we're investing heavily in voter turnout. I mean, there's a reason we did best in the battleground states. If you look at where we did well, right, we were going to win the Georgia Senate race runoff next week. We won in Arizona, almost swept the statewide elected offices. We only lost a superintendent of schools race, but we won Secretary of State. We won governor. We won attorney general. We won the Senate race. And we crushed it in Michigan. We held on to the statewide. We lost the Senate race in Wisconsin, but we held on to the governorship in Wisconsin. We crushed it in Pennsylvania. We won the Senate, the governor, and we actually took control of the state house. I mean, these are in a year where Democrats are supposed to do poorly because of the party in power. The fact that we actually gained in battleground states just shows to the amount of investment that the party and the state parties and people have made in those battleground states. We underperformed in California. We underperformed in New York. We got crushed in Florida. We underperformed in Texas. So really, we now, you know, I can confidently say we have a strong enough organization in battleground states where it looks good for our presidential chances in 2024. What we didn't prove is that we could actually compete in non-presidential states. And that's where most of these Senate battlegrounds are going to be. And most of them are Democratic held. So if we 51 seats, it's important. It's important because it minimizes the influence of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Two, we don't have 50-50 committees anymore. With a 50-50 Senate, the committees were 50-50, making it harder to get stuff out of committees. We don't have that anymore. We're going to have a seat advantage in all the committees in the Senate. But three, if we lose, that gives us a cushion. We can lose two seats in 2024 and still keep control of the Senate. And it'll be tight, but given how we defended all our seats this time, some of them in tough states, gives me hope that we can actually, in a better year, in a presidential year, we can actually defend our Democratic seats, but we have some cushion now. So we get to 51.
So what happens, and one of the headlines on Daily Kos right now is, I'll read it to you. We know the perfect candidate to primary Sinema. We just need to convince him to run. And of course, talking about Ruben Gallego, what's the status of that? And what about Manchin? What's he going to do? Is he going to run again? I guess he is, but there was some speculation. Mm-hmm. You think he'll go ahead and switch party?
No. I don't think he'll switch parties. He's had every opportunity to switch parties. He's pro labor union. He's voted with us on a lot of things that just don't work for Republicans. And I mean, there'd be almost a little bit of poetic justice in him making, you know, being a pain in the ass for the Republicans the way he's been a pain in the ass for us. I mean, you can see him like voting with Democrats on certain issues and abandoning, you know, so he's not, he would be that pain in the ass no matter where he lands. I think that's what he likes to be. He just likes to be the center of attention. All suggestions are right now is that he's running again, and he's been enough of a pain that maybe it's good enough for him to survive. But remember, this is a 40-point Trump state. I mean, this is not a state that should have a Democratic senator at all. So I'm hoping he runs again. I'm hoping he pulls it off. There's literally nobody else in the world that has a remote chance of holding that seat for us. So, unfortunately, he's all we got. But this is, you know, always playing the long game. 2024 looks terrible for us. I mean, there may be a masterstroke of luck. Maybe Republicans implode to a point. There's a scenario where Donald Trump goes against DeSantis, loses the primary, and then tells his people not to vote in November. I mean, that's a real possibility. There's no scenario where a loser Trump plays nice with you know, does the party unity thing in a general election, right? So what happens if Donald Trump and, you know, 20% of Republicans are Trump dead enders? What if they stay home in November? Suddenly, maybe we win seat in Texas. Maybe Ted Cruz is gone. Like there's a scenario where crazy stuff may happen. And so I don't want to completely preclude it, but let's move ahead to 2026. I mean, the map looks better for us in 2026. Maybe that's when we're able to pick up that extra Senate seat. And now we have a filibuster proof majority. Now we can get rid of the filibuster. We have a Democratic House. Things move forward. So we gotta plan towards that point, right? So 2024 in the Senate, it's all about holding our ground. It's about picking up the House, about holding our ground in the Senate and holding the White House, and then taking it from there. And gotta say, Mark, the fact that we did as well as we did this year, the fact that the youth turnout was as high as it was, the fact that our new voter registration numbers were as high as they were, and that those people voted, all bodes very, very well for us moving into 2024. If I'm the Republicans, I am freaking out right now.
Yeah, if you're really serious about winning, if you want to do math to win. We've heard that, you know, even today, that some of them want to do something to bring in more minorities and what have you. Lastly, a little bit, again, another moving to another subject, but we haven't talked about this, I don't think, and I haven't gotten your thoughts on it. Elon Musk and Twitter. What are your thoughts about the state of Twitter and what's happening there? What might happen? And is it time for it to go away? Or, I mean, would you be ready?
No,
to see?
I mean, there's nothing like Twitter, and there's nothing that brings in this many people from so many different walks of life. I'm not interested in coming up with a new echo chamber, you know, Mastodon or whatever, where it's just a bunch of liberals talking to each other. And I'm not saying that's bad. I mean, it's a church analogy. Like, if talking, you know, preaching to the choir is bad, then we wouldn't need churches, right? Preaching to the choir is fine. Like, I'm personally not interested in that because I'm looking at the broader battle of how do we influence reporters to cover things right. And I think Twitter was absolutely critical in pushing back against the red wave narrative. And we killed it. We killed it in the summer. Like, they were done in the summer. It was a lot of people pointing out the special elections. And, you know, if it's a red wave, why are we overperforming in special elections? Why are we winning special elections? And it came back in the end because there was this flood of Republican polls, right? And people like Nate Silver were very invested in the red wave narrative. So, but there was strong, strong pushback. It wasn't, that would not exist without Twitter. Without Twitter, it would have been red wave narrative the entire summer into the fall. And then our side would have thought it was a hopeless cause. And already I think that red wave narrative hurt our engagement, may have cost us the House. And so an entire summer of Democrats are going to lose would have been disastrous. So without Twitter, that's what happens. So I'm not interested in Twitter going away. Now, Musk is doing everything impossible to make it an insufferable place. He's definitely alienating advertisers. He's not going to make it up with subscription revenue. He doesn't know what he's doing. The myth of Musk as a brilliant, I don't know, CEO has been shattered. He's a dumbass. And so what I suspect is going to happen is that he'll, you know, give it another month or two, he'll get bored. And either he will put a CEO who actually is interested in trying to make it work. And that's going to require going back to strong moderation and doing the things they need to do to get those advertisers and to be not to be kicked out of the Google Play and the Apple App Store. Or he may just even sell it at a loss and just walk away. He's got money. He don't give a shit. But It's what people don't sort of, I think the piece that people don't realize, and it's what's going to be his downfall, is that Tesla's audience, his market, are rich liberals. You go to San Francisco, you go to New York City, you go to here in Berkeley, that's who buys Teslas. You don't go to Alabama and see Teslas. You don't go to Texas and see very many Teslas outside of Austin. Conservatives don't buy Teslas because they want to roll coal, right? The idea of an electric car is actually insulting to them. So Musk is alienating his core, the core buyers of the product that is actually the source of his wealth, which is Tesla stock. And Tesla stock is getting hammered. So at some point, there's going to be a real push from Tesla stakeholders and the board to either oust him or to muzzle him. And I don't think you can muzzle Musk. So he may at that point realize like this Twitter thing is just really, really undermining him. And it may be time to cut that loose. And the other piece is SpaceX defense on its revenues, 100% government contracts. And so you're sitting there antagonizing elected officials and government officials And if you're going to go full MAGA, then you're antagonizing the Biden administration, and people are going to make decisions based on who gets those contracts. And so, you know, Jeff Bezos on the other side, he's salivating. He's rubbing his hands in glee seeing Musk make himself toxic. And so when it's time for SpaceX to get the next contract, the issue won't be, can SpaceX deliver? It's going to be Elon Musk is just crazy. And can we trust him to do anything? I don't think we can.
All good points.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Severs with a Q, dailycoast.com, of course. Also, download The Brief wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with everything that's going on, as always, as we get ready in this last month of the year. And get ready for a new Congress and, I guess, somewhat of a new Senate with an extra seat. Hopefully, by the next time we'll talk, we will have that extra seat.
Yep.
Those of you who have friends, family, loved ones in Georgia, Lord have mercy. Send them out today. Early vote. Not hesitate. That is absolutely urgent. We cannot have Herschel Walker win. I got a little bit more trouble with nonpartisan Black Voters Matter too. I was misbehaving, Marcos.
You were to the letter.
I should have texted you this. I didn't see the tweet, but it went viral. I started a chant, vote in the election, not the erection. And we were in a Walmart parking lot, you know, meeting people, said, vote in the election, not the erection. Because Herschel's trying to win the erection. No, we need Raphael to win the election, y'all.
Mark, I want to stress this, because we talked about this before the main election, is the single most important thing anybody can do to win these elections is to vote early. And the reason it's important to vote early is because you have Get Out the Vote operation that's going to be it's going to be fully active on election day. They're going to have lists of voters that have not voted. And the more names are on that list, the less they're going to be able to go down that list. So if you're in Georgia, you vote. You don't want anybody wasting their time trying to call you, knocking on your door, trying to drive you to the polls. Like, you want those people focus on those who may not vote. So that's why voting early is a critical piece. And you see Republicans now, they're saying that, and there's, you know, about Arizona, about Pennsylvania, about Michigan, is that they screwed themselves by pushing everybody to vote election day, because that what that means is that their Get Out the Vote operation has to get everybody out to vote. Our teams could focus on the last 20-30% that hadn't gone out yet. And it worked. So let's do it again in Georgia.
Let's do it again. Thanks, Marcos.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for getting woke and listening to Make It Plain. As always, perform an act of kindness on behalf of an elder or young person. Write a letter to a sister or brother who just so happens to find her or himself incarcerated. Offer libations to the ancestors upon whose sturdy shoulders we all now stand. And above all, give thanks to the God of your understanding by whatever name you call her and him. All God asks of us is that we give each other love. Thanks for giving MIP love. And please remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.